From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, some of the current twists in the Balkan War. Croat and Bosnian government troops recently went on the offensive, winning back a lot of territory from the Serbs. Over 260,000 Serbs have lost their homes since the beginning of August. We'll talk to Roger Cohn, who's been covering the war for the New York Times. He recently traveled through Serbia and Serb-held territory, collecting stories of refugees who feel betrayed by their leaders. The soundtrack of The Wizard of Oz has been released on CD, including some songs that never made it into the film. Lloyd Schwartz has a review. And TV critic David Bianculli reviews two new series that premiere this week, Murder One and American Gothic. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The terrorist known as the Unabomber is calling for a revolution against the industrial system. His lengthy manuscript was published today by the Washington Post in association with the New York Times. The terrorist had threatened to kill again unless his document was published by one or the other newspaper. The Times and the Post, with advice from Attorney General Janet Reno and FBI Director Louis Freeh, decided to publish it as a public safety matter. FBI Special Agent in Charge of the Unabomber case, Jim Freeman, says the decision to publish is helpful to the case.
The decision was not made lightly. It took some time. And then it followed the publication of excerpts from the Unabomber manuscript over the past several weeks, which we in the investigative side found to be very productive in the obtaining of leads that would enhance and advance our investigation.
The Unabomber has said he won't kill anymore if his paper is published, but he has reserved the right to commit sabotage, which he says is the destruction of property, without intending to hurt people. The Unabomber is alleged to have killed 3 people and hurt 23 over the last 17 years. House Democrats took to the floor today, calling on the Ethics Committee to hire an independent counsel to investigate ethics charges pending against Speaker Newt Gingrich. But Republicans rose to object and cut off any floor mention of the pending ethics case. UPI's Carol Van Dam reports.
Colorado Congresswoman Pat Schroeder kicked off the Democrats' call for an independent counsel with broad investigating powers, noting how in 1988 it was Gingrich himself who demanded on the floor a broad ethics probe into former House Speaker Jim Wright's book deal.
He said the rules normally applied by the Ethics Committee to the investigation of a typical member are insufficient in the investigation of the Speaker of the House.
But when Democrats lined up to criticize the ethics panel for even thinking about limiting the scope of the Gingrich probe, Republicans cut them off at the pass.
To be uncovered.
Mr. Speaker,
let's hold the investigation of Speaker Gingrich to
the stand. Mr. Gingrich himself offered some advice on how much authority an outside counsel should have.
This would be
Mr.
wrong.
Speaker,
let me quote what Speaker Gingrich said in 1988.
The panel is investigating Gingrich's college course and his book deal with HarperCollins. Carol Van Dam, Capitol Hill.
Israel's senior military commander says today's hijacker of an Iranian plane was, quote, sick of being in Iran. Lieutenant General Amnon Shahak says the flight attendant who commandeered the plane used a pistol to force the pilots to fly to Israel. He surrendered less than an hour after landing at a remote Air Force base in southern Israel. All 177 people aboard are safe. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 28 points at 47.51. This is NPR. The Egyptian Organization for Human Rights has issued a report blasting conditions in the country's prisons. NPR's Suni Khalid reports from Cairo.
Egypt's leading human rights group condemned the government's policy on prisons, claiming that conditions had led to the deaths of 17 prisoners this year. The Egyptian Organization for Human Rights also said the government routinely mistreats prisoners and denies them medical attention and access to both lawyers and family members. The report said that thousands of suspected or convicted Muslim extremists were being held in remote prisons, especially members of the Al-Gamaa al-Islamiyah rebel group. The Egyptian Interior Ministry declined to comment on the report. The ministry has not recognized the EOHR or other human rights groups. I'm Suni Khalid in Cairo.
The House Banking Committee is considering a measure to eliminate federal thrifts. The panel is looking at whether to make the thrifts become national banks or state-chartered savings and loans by 1998. The committee wants to merge the bank and thrift deposit insurance funds. Lawmakers are also debating whether to overhaul the Community Reinvestment Act, a major fair lending law. The Clinton administration strongly opposes plans to weaken the Reinvestment Act and threatens a veto. Democrats say the measure would release about 90% of the industry from certain lending requirements and limit regulators' power. Regulators say a merge of the insurance funds could lead to insolvency if just one large SNL fails. Nurses have returned to work at L.A. County USC Medical Center. They staged a massive sick-out yesterday, protesting Los Angeles County's decision to lay off, demote, or transfer 6,700 county health workers. The cutbacks are an effort to deal with a $1.6 billion budget deficit. Yesterday's lack of nurses forced the county USC emergency room to turn away ambulances. I'm Corva Coleman, National Public Radio News, from Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The war in the Balkans has taken some dramatic turns in the past few weeks. Croatian and Bosnian government troops have been on the offensive. They've won back most of the territory the Serbs had taken over in Croatia, as well as some of the territory in Bosnia. The Serbs have lost 20% of their territory in the past week. Today, the Bosnian and Croat governments agreed to stop their advance on the Bosnian-Serb stronghold of Banja Luka. That offensive has been threatening the hopes for a negotiated peace. U.S. peace envoy Richard Holbrook wrapped up the latest round of peace talks today, but hasn't yet revealed the outcome of the meeting. NATO bombings of Bosnian Serb targets, which began over 2 weeks ago, helped bring the Serbs to the negotiating table. Roger Cohn has been covering the war for the New York Times. He recently traveled through Serbia and Serb-controlled territory. We called him earlier today in Paris and asked him about the importance of the offensive that's been waged in the past few days around Banja Luka.
Well, Tara, this is an extremely important offensive. It's the biggest offensive since the beginning of the war, and it's led to the capture of a huge swathe of territory. The Serbs, until recently, were holding about 70% of Bosnia. They now hold about 50%, which is about the percentage foreseen in the peace plan currently being pushed by the Clinton administration. So what was going to be done by diplomacy has already been done on the field of battle. And the Bosnian army and the Croats have pushed forward in a quite remarkable way from the west, and the Serbs seem to have virtually imploded. They're holding lines right now around Banja Luka, which is their largest settlement inside Bosnia, and they declare that they are determined to hold on to that. The offensive is the fruit of long preparations by the Croats and the Bosnians. They've gradually been arming themselves since 1992, despite the arms embargo. The United States has turned a blind eye to that arming, although technically it went against the arms embargo. The aim has been to achieve a military balance of power, which did not exist at the beginning of the war when the Serbs simply overran everyone and everything in sight, often brutalizing civilians. So we now have a much more balanced military picture, and we're seeing the fruit of that in western Bosnia right now.
Why have the Bosnian Muslims and Croatians had such a comparatively easy time taking out the Serbs?
I think the Serbs are suffering from several problems, Terry. One is disunity. This has been something that has plagued the Serbs throughout their history. Now we're seeing divisions between Radovan Karadzic, the leader of the Bosnian Serbs, and Slobodan Milosevic, the leader in Belgrade. Those differences have existed for a while, but we're now seeing, I think, the way in which they've sapped the strength of the Serbs. The fact is that the Croats in Bosnia have the full military backing of Croatia. The Serbs in Bosnia no longer have the full military backing of Serbia. Serbia has simply stood by while, for example, the Serbs of Bosnia were bombed by NATO over the past 2 weeks. There's no question that bombing has also sapped the fighting effectiveness of the Serbs. Their communications are in shreds. There are reports that their military leader, General Mladic, is in hospital with kidney problems, and that would certainly also take a toll. And generally, I think 4 years of defending very long front lines, not moving under an economic embargo. When I've been in various Bosnian Serb positions, what I often see are soldiers sitting around playing cards, drinking Slivovitz, the local plum brandy, talking about the great past of the Serbs and the various heroic war efforts in the past, but basically at a dead end in the present. And I think cumulatively over what is now more than 4 years since the wars of Yugoslavia's destruction began, this sitting around in an impasse has taken a very heavy toll on the Serbs, and they're demoralized.
Do you think that if the Bosnian Muslims and the Croats do attack Banja Luka, that Serbia might actually enter the fighting, send troops in?
Well, it's very hard to know at this point, Terry, the way Slobodan Milosevic, the Serbian president, thinks. He started all this back in 1989 by talking about the way Serbs had been persecuted and the need for Serbian unity and a great nationalist revival by crushing the autonomy of various regions in Yugoslavia and taking direct Serbian control, so destabilizing the area. He sent the militias of Arkan and other ferocious militia leaders into Croatia and then later into Bosnia with devastating effect. But for whatever reason, be it opportunistic, probably the most likely, or conceivably even of conscience, who knows, he has become something of a dove. Over the past 6 weeks, 8 weeks, he has stood by while more than a quarter of a million Serbs have been pushed out of their homes. He let Croatia, and probably indeed orchestrated Croatia's retaking of the Krajina, and he hasn't lifted a finger to help the Serbs in Bosnia, either under NATO bombing or under the attack that's now going on from the Bosnian army and the Croats. So whether he would, in fact, feel that Banja Luka represented something more than these previous attacks, I think is very much in doubt. In fact, Milutinovic, his new foreign minister, said that Banja Luka would not be defended by the Yugoslav army, the Serbian-dominated Yugoslav army. So although Richard Holbrooke, the Assistant Secretary of State, who is mediating in the Balkans, has said there is a danger that the Yugoslav army would come in, I think that's more a negotiating ploy on his behalf designed to persuade the Croats and the Bosnians not to go ahead and attack Banja Luka. My feeling is that Mr. Milosevic probably would not intervene, although there must be some mounting tension within his army. There are certainly people in the Yugoslav army who feel that there's been a tremendous cave-in. And I've heard in Belgrade that from people in the army that there are divisions. They're basically around between those Serbs in Serbia who have relatives in Bosnia or Croatia who feel furious over what has been allowed to happen, and the Serbs of Serbia who have no direct family links with the area and so are more concerned to keep Serbia out of the war, as it has miraculously remained throughout the last 4 years.
Do you think that the Western alliance, you know, the NATO alliance, started bombing now because of the Serbian losses in Croatia? You know, because the Serbians were weakened?
I think that the loss of Krajina was a decisive turning point in this war.
Mm-hmm.
It demonstrated once and for all that Slobodan Milosevic, the arch-nationalist of the late 1980s and early 1990s, the man who did more than anything else to destroy Yugoslavia, was not really prepared to fight for Greater Serbia. I mean, this was a big chunk of territory, and he just gave it up. So NATO had always worried that if they bombed the Bosnian Serbs, Serbia would come into the war. Krajina made it transparently clear that Milosevic wants out. So NATO knew that it could bomb without risking widening the war, and a primary concern of the West has always been not to allow the war to widen. I think we also overrated the Serbs. I think the Pentagon, and I've heard this from them, they've gone on about mission creep the whole time, you know, and how just getting in there, and then it could be a quagmire, and then Vietnam, and the Serbs were great fighters in, you know, World War II and all this. I mean, what you often had were a lot of farmers sitting around with a gun and, you know, just sort of not very organized as a fighting force. And I think we waited much too long before using real force to convey the fact that we are serious when we say we're going to do something.
My guest is Roger Cohn of the New York Times. More after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Roger Cohn is my guest, and he's been covering the war in the former Yugoslavia for the New York Times. And he recently traveled through Serbia and parts of Croatia that have been held by the Serbs to see what feelings are now among the Serbs. And he describes Serbia now as a land of broken promises. Roger, you particularly followed one family. Why did you choose that family?
Well, I met them on the outskirts of Belgrade, Terry. They were just one of a very large group of refugees with all their things in, you know, in the back of a trailer, traveling by tractor at about 10 miles an hour. They'd been on the road for about 2 weeks. I've got to know this sort of acrid whiff of poverty and suffering pretty well covering this war. I've seen refugee Croats, refugee Muslims, refugee Serbs. Destroying Yugoslavia meant shifting huge numbers of people to create ethnically pure or largely ethnically homogenous areas. And this particular family, the Miljevic, was just the latest in the group. They felt totally betrayed by Serbia because they felt that Slobodan Milosevic, the president of Serbia, who unleashed Serbian nationalism in 1989 and encouraged them to hang on to part of Croatia, despite Croatia's declaration of independence in 1991, the family felt that he had totally failed to back them in August when Croatian army advanced, and this is true. Milosevic did nothing. They were then directed, they showed me a piece of paper. The paper said Kraljevo, which is a town in central Serbia about 150 miles from Belgrade, and they said they'd just been told to go there at the border. They had no idea why, but people in the Balkans are generally fairly passive in terms of their response to authority, and so off they went. About 4 days later, I found them down there. They'd been thrown into a school. They were sleeping in a gymnasium along with about 400 other refugees. The conditions were appalling. They'd been promised maybe a house or some kind of accommodation, but nothing had been forthcoming. The police then threw me out of this refugee center. They said no journalists were allowed to talk to these people. This is typical of Milosevic. His persona is the man in the suit, ushering American diplomats into plush rooms to talk peace. The man, you know, 1,000 miles from the war and its suffering. So any images or reports on these suffering Serbs are not what Milosevic wants. I was thrown out of there. I did manage, however, to link up with them again in the town, and sometime later, the younger Miljevic, Jelko, age 30, was dragged away by Serbian police without being able to say goodbye to his wife and family, thrown in a bus and bussed off to eastern Slavonia. This is the one remaining Serb-held area of Croatia. He was basically dragooned into the army there. And when I last caught up with him there, he'd not only lost his home in the Krajina, he'd lost his family. Now in Kraljevo, he's no longer allowed back to Kraljevo, so he can't see his little kids. And he's standing on a front line, having been denied the right to defend his own home. I think this is just an example of the way, you know, millions of people have just been pawns in this great shuffling that has gone on and has been orchestrated by politicians who have grown wealthy and more powerful, and none of whom has paid any price for the great suffering that has been inflicted on all the peoples of the former Yugoslavia.
Now, are there a lot of men now who are against their will are being conscripted into the army to fight for the Serbs?
A lot of the refugees being
conscripted? Yeah, a lot of refugees.
Yeah, I think a lot of the men of fighting age are being conscripted. The way this was done was, I would say, typically slick. That's to say that Milosevic did not simply confront them all at the border and dragoon them off into the forces in eastern Slavonia, because there would have been an outcry or an uprising. First of all, they got these pieces of paper which spread them around Serbia. And then gradually, in the 2 weeks since then, the men of fighting age have been rounded up. Actually, many of them have been taken to the so-called military training camp in Erdut in eastern Slavonia of Arkan. Arkan, whose real name is Jelko Reznatovic, is one of the more notorious warmongers among the Serbs. He was very prominent in the ethnic cleansing of Bosnia in the early months. He's known to have worked for the Serbian secret police for a long time. He's wanted for murder in Sweden. He's a pretty brutal character. And he has big business interests in eastern Slavonia, so he's kind of organizing its defense. And the Serbian police is helping him out, as it always has, by delivering these refugees to his doorstep.
You also, in your Sunday New York Times story, told the story of one woman, a Serbian refugee from Bosnia, who fled Sarajevo to Belgrade because she was afraid of the Muslims. She actually fled a few years ago. But now she misses Sarajevo, and she's concluded that she's really more a Bosnian than a Serb. And I found that really interesting. And I was wondering if you think that that's that people's sense of ethnic identity is shifting now.
Well, I found it really interesting too, Terry, and it's an important phenomenon. I mean, everyone assumes that if Bosnia, say, is divided into a Serbian entity and a Bosnian Muslim entity, you know, the Serbs will gravitate towards Serbia and they'll kind of go their different ways. But I think that the people of Bosnia, be they Croat, Serb, or Muslim, in many instances, let's say at least the majority of instances, they are Bosnian. I mean, they have lived in this place with magnificent mountains, rushing rivers, woods, a peculiarly intense mingling of cultures. 40% of marriages were mixed when the wars began. I mean, Bosnia was the heart of Yugoslavia. It was the most multi-ethnic bit of a multi-ethnic state. Now, when this particular woman, Vojna Adamovic, she fled Sarajevo on April 12, 1992, 6 days after the war began, she felt, as a Serb in Sarajevo, she felt frightened. Her husband didn't actually get out until a year and a half later. But in Serbia, she felt like a fish out of water. She finds, when she tells people, for example, that she once visited the United States, she went to Colorado, they say, oh, you're a Bosnian and you went to the United States? I mean, they have this feeling, she thinks, that in Bosnia the people are somehow inferior or they're peasants. And, of course, she finds this offensive. Moreover, the area around Belgrade is totally flat. I mean, Serbia as a whole is not particularly a flat country, but it's not got these endless mountain ranges and valleys of Bosnia. And she finds this flatness increasingly oppressive. She finds it boring. And she's come to see the whole political drive, let's say, for a greater Serbia is something not at all ennobling, far from it. She sees on the whole that the politicians who said they were fighting for that have, on the whole, been lining their pockets, been doing very well out of the war, and that she, for example, has suffered immensely. I mean, she's lost her friends, she's lost her music, she's lost her skiing, she's lost her three-hour drive to the seaside, she's lost her home, which was Sarajevo. And although she's a Serb, she's a Sarajevan. And I think that this will, with time perhaps, prove to be true of many people. After all, Bosnia was totally dismembered by vicious fighting during World War II, and then Bosnia was reconstituted. A lot of people argue that Bosnia does not exist because it wasn't an independent state for 500 years before it gained independence in 92. But Bosnia was a society. It was an odd society. The legacy of various empires, various armies crossing it. And what was left behind was this mixture in this strangely beautiful and moving place. At least I find it to be so.
Roger, is this the first time during the war that you're seeing such anger and bitterness among Serbs?
Well, I think it's been cumulative, Terry. I mean, I think life in Serbia has been no fun for most people over the last 3 years. Economic sanctions have taken a terrible toll. Professionals are earning $100 a month. And in Bosnia, you know, the euphoria of the first brutal campaign where 70% of Bosnia was initially grabbed has been replaced by the drudgery of sitting on what until recently have been largely immobile front lines in growing economic misery. You know, watching everything being sold from arms to gas to the right not to fight on the front line by the cronies of the leadership, and just feeling that this was a moment of folly. So I think this state of dispiritedness and gloom has been steadily mounting, and the Serbs now are in great disarray. They don't know really who their leader is. They don't know what their leaders want. They don't see any positive future to the war, but they're not sure how to get out of the war. Economically, their lives are fairly miserable. And I think many of them just wish that they could get back to something resembling the life they had before this began. So I think, yes, it's an unprecedented mood of gloom. What is interesting is that there is not a mood of uprising, at least in Serbia. That's to say, there is what I find to be a strange and possibly ultimately menacing passivity. I mean, I can't believe that this passivity can last indefinitely, although in the Balkans there is no sense, you know, like we have in the United States, that by acting you can change things. I mean, people tend to think because they were ruled by distant empires for a very long time and then by communist regimes and are used to authoritarian systems that, you know, they don't tend to think they can take their lives into their hands and change something. But I believe that this passivity in Serbia must one day give way to some kind of movement to bring political change.
What kind of promises did Milosevic, the leader of Serbia, make to the Serbian people at the start of the war?
Well, Milosevic came to power in 1987, and he proceeded to destabilize Yugoslavia, which was always a pretty delicate mosaic of nations, religions, ethnic groups, by asserting very strongly that Serbs, who are the most numerous people, were the most numerous people in the former Yugoslavia, had been unfairly treated by Tito, who was part Croat and part Slovenian, and the time had come to avenge these past injustices. He proceeded to take control, direct control, of what were two autonomous bits of Serbia, and he made these vague promises about Serbian unity and a glorious Serbian future, and that Serbs would not any longer take injustices lying down. His election campaign slogan, I think, in 91 was "Serbs do not kneel." This was fairly typical of the tone he was adopting at that time. This was a time of economic decline in Yugoslavia. It was a time of the disorienting collapse of communism, 89-90. And he set this drumbeat of nationalist propaganda going. I mean, the promises weren't particularly precise, but they were enough to get people putting on, you know, Serbian military uniforms from the First World War, the Second World War, bringing out all these memorabilia, you know, drumbeat of nationalist music, reviving the image of the Ustaše, the Croat fascists who massacred Serbs. The Croats were doing the same thing, reviving the image of the Chetniks. These were the Serbian irregulars who fought during World War II and indeed during World War I. And so Milosevic's promise was pretty vague, but the Serbs got the sense that they were going to build themselves a big country full of Serbs. Now Milosevic changed course, and that's marooned a lot of Serbs. They don't know quite where.
Roger Cohn has been covering the war in the Balkans for the New York Times. He spoke to us from Paris. Our interview was recorded earlier today. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The Wizard of Oz soundtrack has been released on CD. We're listening to it now. Coming up, Lord Schwartz has a review. Also, we continue our conversation on traveling through Serbia and Serb-controlled territory with Roger Cohn, who's been covering the war in the Balkans for the New York Times, and TV critic David Bianculli reviews two new series, Murder One and American Gothic.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with the second part of our interview with Roger Cohn, who's been covering the war in the Balkans for the New York Times. On Sunday, he reported on his trip through Serbia and Serb-held territory in Croatia. Over 250,000 Serbs have become refugees since early August as a result of the Croat-Bosnian offensive. The Serbs Cohen spoke with were living in misery, bitter about their leader's broken promises. We called Roger Cohn in Paris earlier today. During this war, you've reported a lot from Sarajevo, where the people have been under siege, under attack,
yes,
by the Serbs. And now you're reporting on the Serbs and seeing the plight of the Serbs and seeing how many of the Serbian people are very angry at their own leaders and have become victims of their own leaders. And I wonder if it's giving you a different picture of the Serbs than you had before, during the time when you were sitting in Sarajevo under siege like everybody else there.
Yeah, of course, when you're in Sarajevo, you empathize totally with the people there, or very largely, and you can only regard the people who are bombarding civilians as monsters. I spent time in Serbia before, and I don't think, you know, my basic view has changed. I still regard what the Serbs did in 92, that's to say, cleaning out 750,000 Muslims from their homes in Bosnia, and then the continued bombardment of civilians in Sarajevo as despicable. And, you know, that has not changed. I've always had in mind, I think, that this was something, you know, driven from the top, driven by Milosevic and then by Karadzic, and that certainly you couldn't say that all Serbs collectively, you know, were responsible for this. I mean, many Serbs have suffered very greatly. What I think is unfortunate is that a lot of Serbs in Serbia, because the official media is absolutely dominant and because it has never portrayed what Serbs did in Bosnia, many Serbs in Serbia just deny outright that any of these things did happen. I mean, generally, Terry, reporting on a war and trying to be objective and fair to all the sides is, I think it's, you know, one of the greatest challenges a reporter can face. I think it is extremely important to get round the three sides of the story and to try and report on all sides. The difficult thing with the Serbs is that their case has not been without foundation at the beginning. At least I think most reasonable people could see that because Yugoslavia was a country in which a lot of Serbs lived outside Serbia, those Serbs outside Serbia, that's to say those in Bosnia and in Croatia, particularly in Croatia where they'd suffered a genocidal assault during World War II, might feel pretty uncomfortable about the breakup of the country. The history of minorities in the Balkans is not that encouraging. However, you know, what was then done with those arguments, and the Serbs have shown a lack of sort of political astuteness and often just basic humanity in the way they've waged this campaign that alienated much of the world. I mean, as early as 1991, they were flattening Vukovar, this beautiful mixed city on the Danube in Croatia, in their bid, ultimately successful, to capture it. I mean, it's really one of those cases that we had to destroy it to liberate it because the city is just totally flattened. So that was one initial image of the war. Then there was the shelling of Dubrovnik, which had the same sort of effect, even perhaps more so. And then right on into all the atrocities in Bosnia and the shelling of Sarajevo. So the Serbs took a case which, if argued politically or in some other way, you know, many people could have understood, and I certainly can understand, and destroyed it.
You said that when you were in Serbia, you found that a lot of the Serbs there basically denied that a lot of the atrocities had happened. Their own press isn't reporting it, and it's, I guess, comparatively easy for them to be in denial because of that.
Right.
Would you try to convince them of what actually happened?
Well, Tara, I've gone through these conversations so many times, I mean, including with intellectuals in Belgrade or influential people who one assumes must be reasonably well-informed, and they will just flat out say, you'll mention, say, the camps in which Muslims were thrust in 1992, for which there is compelling and irrefutable and extremely wide at this point evidence. And they'll just say with a dismissive wave of the hand, Muslim propaganda. Or you'll mention, you know, what's going on in Sarajevo, and they'll say, you know, well, the Muslims were throwing us into camps or were butchering us. Or no, there's no question, you know, that some innocent Serbs have been killed. There's no doubt about that, but there is a massive denial, and there is an overwhelming tendency in these parts of the world to believe what you're told by the boss. You know, one example that I cited in this piece on Sunday was that people under Tito, when the inevitable question arose, particularly as Tito died in advanced old age, you know, what's going to happen after Tito? The reply was always Tito. Tito after Tito. Now, you and I know that makes no sense at all. I mean, we've seen now what happened after Tito, a complete and utter disaster. But people tend to just believe authority, and the message from Belgrade in general has been that, you know, what happened in Bosnia did not include, you know, any of the atrocities that have been very widely reported. I think all journalists who have spent, I started out in Serbia actually in 92, and I listened to all these arguments. Some of the first dead bodies I saw in Bosnia were Serbs lying on the road outside Garajde in August 92. They'd tried to flee, and they'd been caught in an ambush, and they'd been killed. Now, that kind of image affects you very deeply, and, you know, I went to the other side of the lines feeling pretty skeptical about some of the Bosnian arguments. But as you travel around Bosnia, the sheer irrefutable scale of what the Serbs en masse did to the Bosnian Muslims, particularly between April and September 92, you know, is just something that is without any parallel in the war. And that's where the arguments of the people who say that we've been unfair to the Serbs or the Serbs haven't had their case put, I think, falls down, because all the journalists, I think, who've really tried in all conscience to get around this story and talk to as many people as possible, come down with the fact that in Bosnia, the Serbs really had a moment of destructive madness.
You know, the UN Secretary General Boutros-Boutros-Ghali told the Security Council yesterday that it should end the UN peacekeeping operation in Bosnia and replace it with a multinational force. Whether or not current diplomacy and bombing raids lead to a peace agreement, what would that mean?
Well, it's an interesting statement. I think it means that the UN has seen that its usefulness perhaps is dying out, and it wants to cease being any kind of a buffer and just put pressure on the parties to settle. In other words, it doesn't want the Bosnian government, for example, to think that if it chooses to, you know, go on fighting, that anyway the UN will still be around delivering rice and so on. So I think it's a form of diplomatic leverage. It's also an admission that the UN's ability, whether in Srebrenica, in Zhepa, in Krajina, they've basically been bystanders. They've been unable to alter the course of events on the ground. And if we're going into a scenario where massive NATO air power will be used, where the forces on the ground are really waging serious war, then I think Boutros-Boutros-Ghali's conclusion is that the UN is no longer able to play a role, that you need people dressed in green.
My guest is Roger Cohn of the New York Times. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back to our interview recorded earlier today with Roger Cohn of the New York Times. You know, another question about your travels through Serbia. Did you get the impression that any military leaders or Serbian authorities had been following any of your work in the New York Times? And if so, did they particularly not like you because of that?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that is a very constant problem on the Serbian side. I mean, they feel that America is against them, and as a New York Times reporter, you are to them a representative of the United States and of the United States' betrayal of the Serbs. I mean, the United States fought on the side. The Serbs were on the Allied side in the Second World War, in general, at least many of them were. And, you know, they feel betrayed, and I've been arrested in the past, held. When I was in eastern Slavonia this time, there's one remaining Serb held part of Croatia where the soldiers are pretty tense. This guy just came up to me, the soldier, and said, you know, why do you bomb us? Why do you bomb us? Get out of here. And we had a pretty tense exchange. And
what did you say?
I said that, that I was a reporter, that it's in their interest to try and get their point of view, that my very presence there, you know, was evidence that the New York Times, we tried to present a certain point of view, and that he should talk to me, and whatever he talked about, I would report. And he then said, oh, no, your editors will take it out. You know, anything we say is always removed. Nothing that fairly represents the Serbian position ever gets published. And I said that, you know, if I felt that my copy was being edited in such a way, I'd resign. And he sort of laughed at me for saying that. And anyway, we gradually worked our way to the point where we were able to have a drink together, and things became more relaxed. But there is a lot of anger and a lot of indignation, a lot of, you know, they see it. I mean, I put myself in this man's shoes. I mean, he's defending his home. He doesn't see beyond that fact. I mean, he sees himself with a gun in a place where he's always lived, and it's now part of Croatia. And he feels threatened, and he feels that the world is against the Serbs. And to be fair to him, the world probably is against the Serbs. And that's not his doing. But, you know, nor is it the creation of people like me. I mean, it corresponds to deeds that have been committed, you know, alas, by Serbs, and which have betrayed what I think is a generally heroic past. I mean, the Serbs are, you know, they are quite extraordinary people in many ways, and in many ways very attractive people. I enjoy being in Belgrade. They have a warmth, and they have a pride, and they have a culture that are all very strong. My sense is that in the name of a fairly heroic tradition, the deeds of this war have been more about, you know, robbing Muslim women of their jewelry and insulting Muslim men in camps and just sort of basic racism in Bosnia. And not about, you know, the Serbs will tell you that they're still fighting the Ottoman Turks, you know, that this is the last anti-imperial war. They're fighting the Turks who were left behind in Europe. Well, they're not fighting the Turks. I mean, they're fighting people who converted to Islam 500, 400, 300 years ago, and in any way, at least until this war, weren't in the least religious. I mean, they've dreamed up this thing. In Croatia, I find the Serbian case much more compelling because I feel they were provoked by President Tudjman, and because the Ustaše, the Croats, did terrible things to the Serbs 50 years ago, and 50 years is not long in a family. I mean, there are people around who remember that.
Roger, I want to get back to that drink that you had with the Serb who thought that you were the enemy because you wrote for the New York Times.
Yeah.
I've seen this kind of thing in movies. Never has happened to me, right? The worst I have is a bad interview with somebody, and we don't go out for a drink afterwards. But I always wonder, like, in a situation like that, do you feel like, okay, what a relief, now we'll go out for a drink, we'll relax a little bit, and we'll see each other as human beings? Or do you ever worry that, you know, it's going to help you let down your guard if you have that drink, and you might make yourself more vulnerable?
Well, I feel I know the Serbs reasonably well at this point. I mean, they can be very threatening, and the worst that's happened to me is having a Kalashnikov butt driven into my back by a very irate soldier who just suffered a defeat near Bihać last December. And he then ripped up my notebook, and, you know, I felt that was quite frightening. But in general, I find that, you know, they will make their case very forcefully, and they will express their anger. But, you know, if you, the Serbs like you to look them in the eye. I mean, they are, I think the Serbs, as I said, do have a culture and a dignity, which unfortunately I think, you know, there was this moment of folly in which it was deeply betrayed, but of course it wasn't betrayed by everyone. So, you know, you look them in the eye and you try and answer them back as honestly as you can. And, you know, having a drink with the Serbs is, you know, absolutely basic. I don't know what I can compare it to. I mean, having a coffee or something on a break in Washington or something. I mean, it's really, if you don't drink down and if you don't sit down and drink their local plum brandy, the Slivovitz, which very often is grown, you know, in their yard, and then they make it themselves, and it's often excellent, and then they'll bring out, you know, their bean soup or something. And you know, it's a very rustic war, this. I mean, it's a lot of these people are farmers who've just sort of taken up guns to defend their homes.
Roger Cohn covers the war in the Balkans for the New York Times. He spoke to us from Paris. Our interview was recorded earlier today. The Wizard of Oz is one of the most beloved movies ever made, and some of the songs from the movie, Over the Rainbow, We're Off to See the Wizard, and Ding Dong, the Witch is Dead, are among the most well-known. Now Rhino Records has released a 2-disc set of all the music that was composed for the original soundtrack, including some that was never used. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz has a review.
Someday I'll wake and rub my eyes, and in that land beyond the skies, you'll find me. Somewhere over the rainbow, bluebirds fly, birds fly over the rainbow. Why?
The tune and the voice are familiar, but you've probably never heard some of these particular words before. And why is Judy Garland crying? This is actually the reprise of Over the Rainbow that Dorothy sings as a prisoner of the Wicked Witch of the West. It was cut from the final edit. Over the Rainbow itself was nearly dropped because Louis B. Mayer thought it slowed down the action too much and didn't like the idea of an MGM star singing in a barnyard. It went on to win the Oscar for Best Song. The 50-page booklet that comes with these discs is filled with color photos, production storyboards, biographies, notes on all the music, both used and deleted, and lots of stories. Did you know that Ray Bolger was first cast as the Tin Woodman and Buddy Ebsen as the Scarecrow before they switched roles? Ebsen, of course, never appeared in the film because he was hospitalized in an iron lung with aluminum dust poisoning from his Tin Man makeup. But he recorded his songs before he got sick. In fact, his voice remains on the final soundtrack in all the big group numbers. Here he is singing If I Only Had a Heart. The voice of Juliet belongs to Adriana Casalotti, who's even better known as the voice of Walt Disney's Snow White.
Picture me, a balcony, above a voice sings low.
Wherefore art thou, Romeo?
I hear a beat. How sweet just to register emotion. Jealousy, devotion, and really feel the part. I would stay young and chipper, and I'd lock it with a zipper if I only had a heart.
Over the Rainbow wasn't the only award-winning music in The Wizard of Oz. The background music by Herbert Stothart won the Oscar for Best Original Scoring, and it's a pleasure to hear. Not only because it conjures up vivid images from the film, but because it's so inventive and colorful in itself. Stothart is responsible for the music in a wide variety of films that includes Queen Christina, A Night at the Opera, and National Velvet. In Oz, he interweaves his arrangements of Arlen's tunes like Wagnerian leitmotifs, and he makes witty uses of folk songs, music by Mendelssohn and Schumann, and familiar songs like The Whistler and His Dog. But his own original music is also memorable. Think of the poppy field where Dorothy and her friends fall asleep, the ominous march of the Winky Guards, or the music for Mean Miss Gulch, whose bicycle turns into the Wicked Witch's broomstick in Dorothy's cyclone dream. Rhino has done Hollywood and all of us a wonderful service in its series of original movie soundtracks, which also includes Bernard Herrmann's magnificent complete score to Hitchcock's North by Northwest. On the Wizard of Oz discs, what got kept and what got cut out of the film makes its own fascinating story. The Wizard of Oz is really a remarkable vindication of the entire studio system. The production suffered cast changes and script changes and had at least five major directors, including King Vidor, who directed the Over the Rainbow sequence, although final credit was given only to Victor Fleming, who took over another MGM film that same year, Gone with the Wind. And yet out of all this chaos emerged a perfect cast, a perfect score, and a perfect balance of humor, magic, and menace, seamlessly edited. The Wizard of Oz lost the Best Picture Oscar to Gone with the Wind. But of course, the Academy isn't always right.
Lord Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed the CD of the original motion picture soundtrack of The Wizard of Oz. Coming up, a review of two new TV series. This is Fresh Air. Even though more than half of the new fall TV series already have premiered, this week marks the official start of the 1995-96 season. TV critic David Bianculli is excited about two of the new series.
Of all the new shows this year, there aren't really any sitcoms that are so good you have to watch them. But there are two dramas, and you ought to make special plans to watch or record them, because they're worth it. One is Murder One, which premieres Tuesday on ABC. The other is American Gothic, which premieres Friday on CBS. Murder One is the newest series from Stephen Bochco and Company, and essentially, it's a combination of L.A. Law, NYPD Blue, and the O.J. Simpson trial. Murder One is all about a high-profile murder case involving a celebrity suspect, in this case, a rich businessman. The series is presented from the point of view of the guy's high-priced lawyer, but the legal and police procedures are given almost equal time. The gimmick of Murder One is that the story will unfold over an entire season, like the Simpson trial. And the strength of the series is an actor named Daniel Benzali, who stars as attorney Theodore Hoffman. If you watched NYPD Blue from the start, you remember Hoffman as the tough mob lawyer, and remember what a scene stealer he was. He's just as powerful here, Listen to the way he questions his just-jailed client, played by Stanley Tucci, about the murder victim.
Were you having a sexual relationship with the girl?
She was 15 years old.
That's a plus for some people.
Not for me.
What was your relationship to Neil Avedon? Did you take drugs with him? Understand this, Richard. What you're involved in now, facts are weapons. I can be the best lawyer in the world, but if I go in unarmed, I'm gonna get my ass kicked. I'll get over there. But you'll get executed.
That's a great scene. And, like the rest of Murder One, it's addictive and will leave you eager to see more. So will Friday's American Gothic, a CBS drama that comes from the improbable team of former Hardy Boys star Sean Cassidy and Evil Dead director Sam Raimi. American Gothic is as spooky as the best episodes of The X-Files, as unpredictable and original as Twin Peaks, and as hard to describe as any TV show I've ever seen. The best I can do is to say that it's kind of like a dramatic version of The Andy Griffith Show, except that in American Gothic, the sheriff has been possessed by the devil. The sheriff is played by Gary Cole, who was serious and mysterious as Jeffrey McDonald in Fatal Vision, and surprisingly funny as Patriarch Mike Brady in the Brady Bunch movie. In American Gothic, he gets to use both ends of that spectrum. His character is evil and is responsible for most of the bad things that happen in his town, and yet he has a definite sense of humor about himself. If you think I'm exaggerating, or that my Andy of Mayberry parallel is stretching things, listen to what the sheriff whistles as he approaches a murder suspect's jail cell.
Happened, didn't you? You make everything happen.
It's a great joke, and Cole's character knows it's a great joke. He knows TV, and that makes this TV show very unusual. Both of these shows, American Gothic and Murder One, are ambitious and exciting. You've got to watch them, and I have a feeling you have to watch them early, because they both have tough roads ahead and may not be around for very long. Murder One definitely will finish out the season. You can't leave a TV murder trial without a verdict. But next month, it's scheduled to move from Tuesdays to Thursdays, where it'll be opposite NBC's top-rated ER. And American Gothic starts out at 10 p.m. Fridays, putting it right up against Homicide: Life on the Street. But for now, Murder One and American Gothic are the new shows to sample.
David Bianculli writes about television for the New York Daily News. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Naomi Person, Phyllis Myers, and Amy Sallet, with Alan Tu and Nancy Updike, research assistants from Rena Bander. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Living Language. Language instruction at home or on the go with Living Language. Celebrating 25 years of radio excellence, this is NPR, National Public Radio.